The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement, which is entirely responsible for its content.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Now your host, Roger Waldron.
Today my guest on Off the Shelf is Thad Allen. Thad is Executive Vice President with Booz Allen Hamilton, and he is a leader in the firm's Department of Justice and Homeland Security business market and focusing on security issues. We're going to talk about that today in terms of position, navigation, and timing. And most people know, and all my listeners in the Washington, D.C. area know Thad as in his distinguished career, where he culminated serving as the 23rd Commandant for the Coast Guard. Thad, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
I'm looking forward to this conversation. It's about something that touches all our lives day in and day out in so many different ways that I learned just, you know, reading some of the background information. Just fascinating stuff. We're going to talk about position, navigation, and timing, and otherwise I would just refer to it as GPS. That's what I know it as in some senses. And I know, Thad, one of the things you do is you serve on the space-based position, navigation, and timing advisory board to the GPS executive committee. So first, that's a mouthful. So first, what is that and what's your role there?
It is a mouthful. The PNT advisory board is a federal advisory committee that provides subject matter expertise to the GPS XCOM. The GPS XCOM is the governing body for GPS policy in the U.S. government. It's co-chaired by the deputy secretaries of the Department of Defense and the Department of Transportation. Our job specifically is to provide them subject matter expertise and advice on issues related to position, navigation, and timing, which are the three products that GPS delivers.
Right. So, that sort of touches, well, there's obviously the military applications, right, day in and day out that, you know, we've seen since, I guess, Desert Storm, really, on the team, you know, but also it's the stuff that we deal with every day in our car or in financial institutions, timing of things. Can you talk a little bit of just generally what GPS is? And I know, I understand, and I didn't know this, there are multiple systems around the world, I guess, sort of four distinct, I think.
That's correct. The GPS is part of what we would call a Global Navigation Satellite System, or a GNSS. GPS happens to be the American version of that. There is one that has been deployed by China called Beidou. There's a European Union system called Galileo, and the Russians have a system called GLONASS. All four of them provide basically the same services: position, navigation, and timing information through satellite constellations.
Right, and currently, I just go back to the advisory board. What are you guys focusing on right now?
Well, the advisory board is really there to represent the civil users. You know, okay, there's a military application of GPS, and that's pretty much taken care of by DOD. But with the broad penetration of GPS into our daily lives, the ubiquitous of the technology, our main goal is to make sure that we're representing those civil users and that we have assured position, navigation, and timing. And there are vulnerabilities and threats out there that we need to consider and address.
Yeah, and I know we're going to spend some time on those vulnerabilities and threats, but can you talk, it is ubiquitous. It touches us each and every day. Can you talk a little about some of the areas that it does touch us that, you know, folks out there might have not even realized or thought about?
Yeah, I guess the first thing to understand is with the advances in technology and microchipping, a GPS receiver now is smaller than a penny in some cases. And this has allowed the GPS chips to be put into a lot of different types of devices, including transportation devices, mobile devices. And as we know now, we're able to connect the internet with mobile devices, and GPS provides a geolocation part of that. And it's just about everything we use.
Right. And I understand, too, that in terms of timing, that even in financial institutions, they use it for timing purposes, if I read that correctly, for like when trades and things like that. Is that correct?
If you think about the globalization of commerce in the world and the fact that we all work on a 24-hour schedule, there's someplace open doing business 24 hours a day. The timing of transactions becomes particularly important as regards to stock trades and moving of financial instruments and so forth. There needs to be a generally agreed upon or universally agreed upon source of time and how those things are timed, because the sequence, as you might imagine, is pretty important in the way these businesses operate. So the timing portion of PNT is considerable interest to everybody.
Right. You know, milliseconds can mean lots and lots of money, right?
That's right.
In the world we live in today. It's amazing. And I am a layperson. I know nothing about this. So when we, so I go back to some of those questions. I just interesting that, you know, there are multiple systems that you mentioned them. But how, I mean, again, remember, please forgive me, I'm a layperson on this, but it's like, how does it work? Do, you know, we have our GPS system. Is that worldwide? Is it just North America? And that's sort of the same question for, like, you know, the Chinese have theirs, the Russians, the Europeans.
Yeah, these systems generally have worldwide coverage, but they have a higher degree of accuracy, and they're better in some parts of the world than others.
Right.
The United States operates a constellation of satellites. And the goal is to have four satellites within range of the chip that's receiving it. And then when you get the distance of those four satellites, that fixes the position on where you're at.
Okay. So, can be moved around or adjusted or not? Is that?
So they're pretty much in a fixed plane. You need to know is where the satellite's at. And then you can measure the difference in the time of the signal that you receive. And that gives you basically, if you can imagine, a radius.
Sure.
From the satellite, if you get four of those, then you know where you're at.
Right. So it's almost, when you describe it to me, that's analogous to, like, you know, a radio tower or something. It's fixed in place, but it's in space, and it's right.
Right. Just have to know where it's at in a particular time, and then you can measure the distance by the timing of the signal.
Right. So now turning again to the advisory board, the PNT advisory board. You guys are supporting PTA. Well, I know what PTA is in the school context, but it's here. It's protect, toughen, and augment strategy. And I guess first, you know, why that strategy? What's going on out there that, or just in terms of this technology, that whether man-made, natural threats to, you know, the GPS system that we have?
Well, to begin with, the PNT Advisory Board has an extraordinary amount of subject matter expertise, including Professor Brad Parkinson from Stanford, arguably one of the fathers of GPS. As we look at the civil users of GPS and the potential to have that service interrupted, we think about how we might minimize vulnerabilities or harden the system, if you will, to make sure that we can always provide those services. We think the simplest way to explain this and to have the conversation about it is to divide it up into three parts, and it's protect, toughen, and augment. If I could take the protect first.
Yeah, let's start with that.
It's basically protect the signal.
Okay.
GPS signal coming from a satellite down to receiver, it works at very low power because it's line of sight and there's no barriers, and it is subject to interference, adjacent frequencies where there may be a loud noise, if you will, using a metaphor. So the first thing we want to do is protect that signal to the maximum extent possible. The second thing, toughen, that is in regards to the receivers. Not all receivers are created equal, and some are more competent than others, if you will, to recognize spoofing and other problems that might be associated with that signal they're receiving. So working with the software and the firmware, the hardware in the chips to harden them so they're less vulnerable to spoofing or jamming. The third is augment. We know that we have a problem in space, it could be space weather, it could be a lot of things. If we lose the signals to the satellites, is there a redundancy to provide PNT? Prior to the ubiquitous dependence on GPS, we had something called Loran-C.
Mm-hmm.
It was a terrestrial-based aid to navigation that operated at very low frequency, actually followed the curvature of the Earth, and could penetrate buildings and urban canyons. The discussion right now is whether or not we need both a space-based and a terrestrial source of PNT to make sure we have redundancy in case there's a failure on one.
Okay, so the terrestrial, i.e. Earth-based, right? I mean, that's for
yes.
me. that no longer exists in the United States right now. Is that shut down, or what is the deal with that?
Well, at one point, we had Loran-C coverage over almost all of the Earth, and a lot of that was actually managed and operated by the United States, actually the United States Coast Guard, clear back to the 1950s, operating Loran stations. There was Loran-A.
So you're very familiar with that, right?
Yeah. In fact, I was a commanding officer of a Loran-C station in Thailand at the end of the war in Vietnam.
Oh, wow. We'll have to talk some more about that.
Yeah, as GPS came into being and its ability to cover wide areas,
mm-hmm.
kind of overtook Loran in terms of technology and the ease of users and the receivers and so forth. So in the last decade, we've slowly shut down Loran operations that were operated by the Coast Guard. They're having second thoughts now whether or not that was a good decision given the vulnerabilities to GPS, and that is a current discussion.
Okay. And Thad, we're already up on the break for the first segment. My guest today is Thad Allen. He's Executive Vice President of Booz Allen Hamilton, formerly the 23rd Commandant of the Coast Guard, and is currently a member of the Space-Based PNT Advisory Board. We're talking about GPS, navigation, all that stuff that touches us each and every day, and how to protect it. Toughen it and augment it. You are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
Brought to you by CGI, a global leader in IT, business process, and professional services. CGI partners with federal agencies to provide end-to-end solutions for defense, civilian, and intelligence missions in areas such as cybersecurity, cloud, and big data. Experience the commitment at cgi.com/usfederal.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Thad Allen. Thad is Executive Vice President at Booz Allen Hamilton. He is a leader in the firm's Department of Justice and Homeland Security business consulting area. Thad also was the 23rd Commandant of the Coast Guard and played a big role in responding to Hurricane Katrina, and I was in the government at the time. Everybody was responding, but you did a yeoman's work in that area. And we're going to talk a little bit about leadership and unity of effort later in the show. But this segment, we're going to continue talking about GPS and position, navigation, and timing, why it's so important, what threats are, and what thought leaders and the government are looking at to try to respond to those potential threats. So I want to get to a sort of a governance question. Thad, you are a member of the Space-Based Position Navigation and Timing Advisory Board that advises the higher-level GPS Executive Committee. So who's on the Executive Committee, and what's its sort of role, I guess, to the next step that you guys are advising? And you did mention it's a great list of subject matter experts in this area.
Right. The GPS XCOM basically is the governing body in the federal government for GPS, specifically as it relates to the civil users, the non-DOD users. As I said earlier, it's co-chaired by the Deputy Secretary of DOD and the Deputy Secretary of Transportation and the other department and agencies that have policy roles in GPS are all members of that. And they're the ones that basically create consensus and create policy in the federal government for GPS.
Right, and that policy turns into implementation, operations, or just where you're going to make all those kind of things, investments.
Roles and responsibilities of the different agencies, yes.
Right. Okay. So that's and that ultimately leads to how our GPS system and any redundancies we create in the future, what they're going to sort of look like. Is that fair to say?
That is fair to say, and our advice from the PNT Advisory Board is to focus on protect, toughen, and augment, as we said earlier. Right now, a lot of emphasis being placed on protect the signal.
Yeah, so why don't we talk about a little bit more about protect the signal? You mentioned in the last segment that it's, I guess, and again, I'm a layperson, low frequency, because there's no...
Low power.
Low power, there, yes. See? Thank you for correcting me. So, and you talk a little bit about what that means and what the threats to that are. Can you talk a little bit about that again, and then also what's being looked at to address that?
First of all, I think it's useful to understand that until we started sending electromagnetic waves through the atmosphere, spectrum really wasn't an issue in this country. But as technology has allowed us to use wireless applications, the use of spectrum for any kind of uses, whether it's cell phone or military uses or whatever, the spectrum's getting pretty crowded. Yeah. And there also is a desire by the federal government to make sure as much of that spectrum is made available for commercial organizations as possible. Where you have issues is where you have frequencies that are very close to each other, and what those are being used for, and whether or not there's any kind of spillover or what we would call signal-to-noise ratio that might affect adjacent frequencies. So one of the real challenges right now is to make sure that GPS spectrum that's used, which is very valuable, and we all know how widespread it is protected by adjacent frequencies where there might be operations there because of the power.
Okay.
Might block out the GPS signal, and that's something that's being looked at very closely right now.
So when you say it's protected, does that mean there's going to be again, buffers between it, or what adjacent to it is looked at very closely, and in terms of
And at the risk of, I don't want to dumb this down, but
I mean, I'm trying to dumb it down for myself there, so that's okay.
If you can think about riding on Amtrak and being in the silent car, and being able to just sit there and think without the noise from other people talking. So if you think about adjacent chatter that interrupts the ability to communicate, maybe that's a simple way to look at it.
Okay. Yeah. And I like the silent car. That's my favorite car. Yeah, you use it all the time. Okay. So in terms of, and I guess, I don't know if this is a fair question, creating that silent car, what is being looked at?
What you want to be able to do is have the GPS signal be transmitted and have it unfettered or diluted by adjacent frequencies that might cause some kind of a spillover that would interrupt the transmission. That's basically it.
Okay. So, and Tuffin, how does that sort of relate to protect, or is it, it's obviously a different aspect of it because it's there, protect, Tuffin, and augment.
All GPS chips, they're really chips now, are not created equal.
Okay.
Some of them have a higher degree of reliability and survivability. And so the question is, and there's not a lot of, there's no overriding standard on what kind of performance you need out of a GPS chip when you put it in either an automobile or a watch that you're wearing.
Right.
So the notion of making sure you have the most competent GPS receiver you can is really important. And that's to the extent that you can use software, firmware, or hardware to actually toughen the receiver so it's less susceptible to jamming or spoofing is another way to assure PNT. And that's where we get to the toughen side. It's toughen the receiver.
Right. Does that mean or evolve into, industry standards or, when you mentioned toughen it, I think like NIST or something like that, where there'd be some sort of standard. Yeah,
raising a good point. I think GPS, like a lot of other technologies, evolve so rapidly.
Uh-huh.
That in terms of national standards and international standards between all of these navigation satellite systems, there is an issue out there about what standard you need to be manufacturing to in terms of toughness. And I think right now it's pretty much a market decision by who's selling the device and how it performs and what the public wants.
Right. So it's driven by market forces, in a certain sense.
Yeah, the market forces, are well ahead of the regulatory environment here.
Yeah, that's a big, that's interesting. That's a big challenge. I think you see that in government day in and day out, whether it's this area, whether it's cybersecurity, all that technology, the market, and what's happening out there. The government has it's just a natural challenge. The government has a huge, challenge. Challenge in trying to maintain some line of sight to where the market is going.
Too much off the topic this morning,
it's okay.
But 2 weeks ago I was in Detroit for an automotive cyber summit looking at connected automobiles and issues related to cybersecurity in automobiles. And it's very well attended. The keynote was by Mary Barra, the CEO of GM. Secretary Fox from Transportation was there, and Mark Rosikin from the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration. We had an interesting conversation in a panel I was on.
Sure.
About what is the best way to deal with these things on emerging technology. And the problem is the regulatory cycle in the federal government is so long.
Yes.
It's years.
Yeah.
And if you're going to be trying to capture the implications of a technology and try and establish standards, you're going to be shooting well behind the target related to technology, which puts a premium, in my view, on the government and industry having open, transparent conversations and working these things out as the technology evolves.
Right.
In a partnership.
Right.
Because you're co-producing the outcomes for the American public. And I think that's probably true of all these emerging technologies.
Right. And that's a great, great segue or just sidebar story. I mean, not segue, sidebar, because it gets back to, I think, your service on the advisory board. That's part of that transparent, that conversation. It's a tool by which industry and government can get together and talk about these issues, these cutting edge issues and where things are going to try to figure out collectively how the government can or can't respond. Is that fair?
Yeah, you make a very good point. Under the Federal Advisory Committee system, the Sunshine Law applies under Title V of the U.S. Code. And so all of our meetings and the records and the presentations and everything are made public. There are notifications in the Federal Register. And all the information is out there for the public to see. And that is one way to create a common sense of what the problem is and what we might do about it. short of actually having to go through a regulatory process, which is grueling.
Oh yeah, I worked in procurement all those years, and like to get a rule done, man, it takes forever. And that's just procurement. We're not talking about procurement should be fairly straightforward. We're not talking about technology or cyber or GPS, that kind of thing. It's amazing. It is.
I used to tell the flag officers who work for me in the Coast Guard that the Code of Federal Regulation is the sum of all market failures.
That's right. That's a great way to put it. To me, I always viewed it as something like where you regulate to the worst case scenario, right? You think, so you come up with a bad fact pattern that something had happened, and you said the response is, okay, we got to create a regulation to address that, right?
Yeah, obviously, it's a takeoff on some of all fears.
Right. Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Wow, we're already up on the next break, Thad. My guest today is Thad Allen. He's Executive Vice President for Booz Allen Hamilton. And he's also a member of the Position Navigation and Timing Advisory Board to the GPS Executive Committee, which is made up of all federal agencies and looking at GPS and where we're going on it. We're going to take a break right now, but when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about the, we didn't get to really augment all that much. We can talk a little bit about that, some of the vulnerabilities and other risks, and and some more a little bit about the strategies. You are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Thad Allen. Thad is Executive Vice President at Booz Allen Hamilton. He is also a member of the Space-Based Position Navigation and Timing Advisory Board to the GPS Executive Committee. That's a mouthful, Thad, every time, but it's important to lay that out. We're talking about the advisory board supports PTA, which is Protect, Toughen, and Augment. And I think we wanted to talk a bit more this segment about augment, what does that mean, and what the strategies are in that area. So I'm going to just turn it over to you and go ahead,
sure.
Thad.
Well, after you protected the signal and toughened the receiver, the next thing you need to look at over the things you can control is how to create redundancy and resiliency in the system. In this case, we're talking about terrestrial-based means or earth-based means by which you can acquire those three things, P and T, as a backup to GPS. In the 2009-2010 timeframe, there was a decision made by the administration that we would get out of the business of Loran C, which was the predecessor in terms of electronic navigation. That's being rethought right now, both within the administration and on the Hill. There's been a strategic pause related to the divesting of real property and equipment associated with that while we take a look and see what the real requirements are for a terrestrial backup for GPS. In this case, the new term is ELORAN, because there are more things based on technology we could do with that signal, including putting data in it that would make the signal provide much more utility to the user.
Okay. And yeah, I can imagine the technology now today versus, when the system was really, up and running is the things that you could possibly do with that. Is that the only option that folks are looking at? Does it have to be, there's only two, like you got space-based, you got, ground-based. Is that
There are other methods to fix your location. You can actually do it with the timing of signals from cell phone towers.
Okay.
Yeah, the question is to create something that's ubiquitous enough mm-hmm. that you can assure that you have PNT when you need it. Some of that can be provided by other means, but in this case, they're looking at a more comprehensive approach to augmentation, which would be some kind of a LORAN technology.
Okay. So can you explain a little bit more like how LORAN works?
Sure.
And not to be too geeky here, but I it's fascinating stuff.
Well, I don't know enough about all this really to be that geeky, I guess.
Okay. That's my idea.
You fix your position in GPS by measuring the signal from a satellite, and it gives you a range to the satellite, and multiple ranges gives you what we would call a fix or fix mm-hmm. your position. LORAN is based on a tower sending out a signal. The original LORAN, a tower would send out a signal. It would be received by a second tower, which would retransmit the signal. LORAN receiver would pick up the first signal, then the second signal, and measure the time difference between them.
Okay.
That time difference would put you on a hyperbola between the two points. Okay. Not to get too mathematical.
Right, but that's how you figure out where that
right.
you
so
are.
For, so right. for each pair of LORAN stations, you could have one line on where you're at. So if you have two or three, then you have two or three lines to potentially cross to tell you that you're in that position.
Okay, and then you said earlier in the show this is a worldwide system.
Well, it was based on the limits of the radio frequency.
Right.
distance. But, and what you have is you have a Loran primary transmitter and then a secondary transmitter, and the baseline, the distance between those two towers, creates the coverage area and actually the accuracy. The shorter the baselines, the more accurate they are. The longer the baselines, the greater the coverage, and there's a trade-off there.
Right. And so, you know, how many – I mean, we're talking about a lot of towers or
– Well, for instance, you might have a primary station or a master station, and you might have three or four secondary stations that would, that would generate lines of position. So that would be a single – what we would call a Loran chain. And then there are multiple chains.
Right.
And sometimes they overlap and use some of the antennas on two different frequencies.
Right.
For different chains.
Okay. And so, and you mentioned earlier in the show that you were stationed when you were the Coast Guard, in the Coast Guard, you were stationed in Thailand and, you know, were ran a Loran
transmitting station. Yes.
Transmitting station. So, first, like, what was, what did that, you know, how did that play? I mean, what was it used for? In certain, I mean, I think we can figure it out, but you can talk about that a little bit.
In the 1960s, the military requirements to fix positions for tactical and strategic aircraft maneuver, you know, bombing sites and things like that required not only greater accuracy, but redundancy. One of the things Loran gives you, if you go to the time difference and you go back to the time difference, the repeatability of where you're at is very, very high. But you don't go back to a latitude and longitude. You go back to the time difference that you measured. And as it evolved over there, the Coast Guard went in and put a Loran chain in Southeast Asia with a master transmitting station down by Bangkok, Thailand. Then there were three other stations, one in northern Thailand where I was, one at Tan My during the near the demilitarized zone near Wei, and then one down in the Konsan Islands off the Mekong Delta. That master in those three stations basically gave an architecture for navigation, which was redundant and accurate enough for the military forces to use.
Okay, and they and so they just would be part connected to that system, or how does that?
Well, if you have a Loran receiver, it's simultaneously receiving time differences.
Okay,
from those three pairs of stations, but they all share the master station in common.
Okay,
and that gives you three different lines, and where the three lines cross, that is your position.
Yeah. So what was, I mean, I just, you know, aside from the technology and the applications of it, what was it like, you know, being stationed there, you know, how long were you there?
Well, it was pretty challenging for a 25-year-old kid.
Yeah, I bet. I can imagine.
Had a crew of about 35. We were about 500 miles north of Bangkok, near the northern provincial capital of Chiang Mai in Thailand, kind of equidistant from Burma and Laos. And our job was to stay on air.
Yeah.
And if we were off air or out of tolerance with the time difference in it for any period of time, I usually got a call from an Air Force general.
Right. I can imagine. Yeah. And that wasn't a pleasant call, right?
No, it wasn't a pleasant call.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's interesting. This is a technology that's been around for a long, long time. And it says something about it that we're looking at it potentially or doing this strategic pause to figure out whether or not it, you know, we as the United States government and society want to make investments in it for a next generation in a certain sense to supplement that. That says a lot about its capability, does it not? Or
well, it does, and I'm not trying to minimize its effectiveness because it was an extraordinary navigation tool for a long time. But it's not that high tech,
right?
If you think about one of those classic AM stations in Mexico in the 60s that's broadcasting, you can hear it in Michigan.
Right.
You know, a Loran station is basically a big radio transmitter, operates at low frequency, so the signal follows the curvature of the earth and can penetrate, you know, buildings and urban canyons. So it's got some functionality that the GPS doesn't have that also makes it useful as a redundant system.
Sure. And well, when you describe it that way, it's, you know, there is power in simplicity, right? If you get, you know, in terms of the more complicated something is, the more ways it could potentially break down, right? Right.
Yeah. In my Loran station, basically, we had a transmitter building, and it was basically a huge radio transmitter that you could walk inside.
Yeah. Wow. Wow. And I think you mentioned, you know, we were talking, you mentioned your father actually built a Loran station. Is that correct? In Philippines?
Yeah, my father was retired chief petty officer from the Coast Guard, and he deployed with a detachment to build a Loran station in the Philippines during the Korean War. That was a Loran A station.
So you're keeping this all in the family, aren't you, Eric?
Trying to.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So just quickly, we got about a minute left in this segment. Do you have a sense of where this is going to go, or are we still in a phase where we're trying to figure out what the options are?
I think the PNT Advisory Board feels pretty confident that the PTA, Protect, Toughen, and Augment approach is the best multidimensional approach to it. The question is, how do you execute in those three lines of effort? And each one of them has its challenges, and each one of them operates kind of in a different technology area. And our goal is to provide the very best advice we can to the GPS-XCOM and represent, if we can, the civil users of GPS to make sure that they have assured PNT.
Right. And is there a sense of a timeline, or is there a sense of urgency about this? It's a crystal ball question. How is this going to evolve over time in terms of addressing Protect, Toughen, and Augment?
This kind of gets back to the earlier discussion we have about regulatory processes versus technology.
Yeah, yeah.
What the Federal Advisory Committee process allows us to do is provide real-time recommendations in the context of the technology as it emerges. But then it's up to the industry and the government to kind of co-produce the outcome based on cooperation, trying to understand what it is you're trying to solve without a result to any kind of a regulatory process, which will take years to solve. And I think we would like to see things happen based on mutual interest. Mm-hmm. We have another larger issue, and that's these other global navigation satellite systems and international standards by which they operate in terms of signal availability and integrity. So if you look at Galileo, Beidou, or GLONASS, the international community is struggling the same way to try and catch up with the technology, and what should international standards be?
Right. I'll ask you a question about the standards and consensus-based standards when we come back. But right now we do have to take a break. My guest today is Thad Allen. He's Executive Vice President for Booz Allen Hamilton. He also serves as a member of the Space-Based Position Navigation and Timing Advisory Board. And you are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Thad Allen. Thad is Executive Vice President at Booz Allen Hamilton, focusing on Homeland Security issues, Department of Justice, and fundamentally looking at government policies, implementations, programs that protect the homeland. And Thad, when we took the break, we got back on. We've touched on a little bit a couple times during the show that the regulatory process versus technology, there's such a gap between the two that the government is always seeming to try to catch up, and I think you see that across government and in the acquisition system and how that works as well, and acquiring goods and services. Can you talk a little bit more about that? I mean, the challenges of developing standards, consensus-based standards, is there, industry driving those standards with collaboration in government? Is that a more efficient way, or just how some of these things all fit together? Can you give us a couple
maybe
examples?
Maybe as a scene setter, if you take a look at the world we live in right now, there's no complex problem or complex acquisition of technology that can really be done by any entity by themselves. In the federal government, you're constrained by your authorizing legislation and your appropriations. Companies are constrained by whether or not they're publicly or privately traded and how they're regulated. That's number one. Number
right.
two,
yeah.
I think there are things that used to be done solely inside the government that are now moving to the private sector. Overhead imagery would be one of those things, where the means of production now don't reside entirely inside the government.
Mm-hmm.
So this notion of what was a publicly produced good versus a private good, that dividing line is becoming very, very muddled right now. And it's clear to me that if you're going to deliver the performance the public expects, whether it's responding to an incident, acquiring technology, or actually operating a government program, the outcomes are going to be co-produced, either by multiple government agencies because acting alone, they can't do it, or by the government and the private sector because they will need that ability to bring the means of production that both of them own to solve the problem. And I think that's the challenge of both acquisition and regulatory reform that we face in government today.
Yeah, it's you mentioned when we were in the break, like the complexity of just thinking about whether it's FAA and the Coast Guard and what's regulated, there versus the international standards, and you touched on that a little bit in in the last segment. Can you give people a quick, it was fascinating when you described it during the break.
I'll just use the Coast Guard as an example because I'm familiar with it. The Coast Guard is the competent authority to regulate shipping in the United States. So if you fly a U.S. flag and you're subject to the U.S., you have to have a certificate to be able to operate that's issued by the Coast Guard. And that means you've met certain safety standards that are published in regulations. And that's how the shipbuilders and the ship operators know what they have to adhere to. But every country does that.
Right.
And the question is, since we're operating a global commons right now, how does that really work? And what we've seen over the last several decades is a migration of domestic standards and trying to come to common standards internationally. In this case, it would be through the International Maritime Organization, which is a subset of the UN that basically is the global regulatory body for shipping. And because we have fewer ships flying the U.S. flag, we want to be sure that foreign flagships that arrive in the United States are adhering to safety standards. The ones that we can enforce are the ones issued by IMO because we're signatory to those treaties.
Right, and that's replicated across, different
for
industries.
For the FAA, it would be the International Civil Aviation Organization. That's correct. So if you look at, for instance, you look at GPS and PNT, those international structures aren't evolving as fast to keep up with the technology, be able to say, well, what is going to be the global standard for reliability and integrity for GPS signals or GNSS signals?
It's amazing. Listening to you describe that one of the things I wanted to take a few minutes, and we got just a few minutes left in the show, is to talk to you about some of your philosophy about leadership. One of the things that you are known for, your role and your service in response to Hurricane Katrina, for example, the oil spill and working on that. And one of the things that it's a term that I've heard you use many times before, unity effort, and particularly with regard to the oil spill. I think that's a great terminology, and you're known for bringing government, industry, all kinds of stakeholders together in a unity effort. So can you talk a little bit about your views on that?
Sure. If we go back to what I talked about, there necessarily being a collaboration between the government and the private sector to solve technical problems, well, somehow you're going to create a basis to do that, and the capability you need to bring to it is you're all unified under agreement. There's a common goal to be achieved, and you can subscribe to what you're trying to do. In terms of the responses I was involved in, it was ability to mobilize folks not only across government but into the private sector and then vertically down to state and local governments to all subscribe to what it is we're trying to do, and then everybody pull in the same direction and having that unity that creates synergy about everybody being involved. And in the case of the oil spill, the first thing we had to do was cap the oil, stop the oil, and then keep the oil offshore, and then the last case, then deal with this oil as it came ashore. So when you're trying to prioritize resources and everything like that, the number one issue is stop the flow out of the well.
Right.
Yeah, but you have to have agreement on what you're doing there so everybody understands what it is you're trying to do. During the hurricane, the turning point for me was when I addressed a group of people in Baton Rouge after I relieved Mike Brown of the response. And I basically told them they were to start treating everybody they came in contact with that had been impacted by the hurricane as if they were a member of their own family.
Yeah.
That's very simple, very easy to understand. It creates
a
set of values that everybody can subscribe to and kind of pulls everybody together.
Yeah. Yeah. And when you describe that, people don't understand and appreciate in both those situations, it seems to me, the complexity of, in the sense of all the different organizations that you're dealing with. You've got the federal government, but the federal government is many different departments that could theoretically be touching, whether it's Hurricane Katrina or the oil spill response. Then you have the state and local governments, and then you have the private sector who's being contracted with to respond to it, but also who have been impacted by it. And then you've got the individual citizens. How do you pull that all together?
Well, if you don't sit back and really try and understand what it is you're trying to do, complexity becomes a tremendous risk aggravator.
Yeah.
And sometimes you have to challenge assumptions and say, we need to change how we're thinking about this problem so everybody kind of sees it from a different angle. The best way you can do is remove yourself from the situation where you're so close to it that you can't really see what's going on. You got to challenge some paradigms.
Right.
Yeah, and in both the oil spill and the hurricane, that's pretty much what we had to do.
It's kind of take a step back and just look at, okay, what's going on here? And do you find that you talk about the complexity, you mentioned the complexity of those things. And then you mentioned the fact that your statement to folks in Baton Rouge was, you know, we're going to treat everybody like they're a member of your family who's been impacted by this thing. Do you find that, you know, that those kind of simple, powerful sort of statements, visions, is that what, to me, that seems like that's what really moved people to do the right thing. Is that what you found in your leadership
career?
Well,
that was a pretty tense time. I held that meeting right after we had the press conference in which Secretary Chertoff announced that Mike Brown would be leaving and I would be taking over.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody was pretty much downtrodden. I had one FEMA worker tell me that every time she went back to her room at night, she couldn't turn on the television because all she saw was her organization and her leaders vilified.
Yeah.
And it was a need to kind of bring everybody together. And that's what I was trying to do more than anything else. So functionally, it wasn't going to change our capabilities, our capacity. What you really want to do was change the attitude about what we were
morale,
trying to do.
Right.
And a lot of people need to know that the boss has their back.
Yep. Yeah. That's, to me, just, you know, working in government, my career, that's one of the that leadership that the boss does have your back, right? That and picking the right people to work for you, it seems, are two of the big keys. Is that your experience?
No, I believe that's true. And if you think about it, that transcends everything. I get asked sometimes by some mid-level senior folks in government. I said, "Well, yeah, but you were the senior officer and you had all these resources." I said, "No, this works right in the workplace.
Yeah,
this transcends everything."
Right. Right, and I know you graduated from the Coast Guard, and you're playing a role there in providing teaching leadership. Can you talk a little bit about that real quick? We got about a minute left.
We've created the James M. Loy Institute for Leadership, named after one of my predecessors, Jim Loy, who was a commandant, also Deputy Secretary of Homeland Security. I serve in the James Tyler Chair at the Institute for Leadership, and I'm up at the academy every 4 to 6 weeks teaching courses, interacting with the cadets, and working on the development of a long-term deployment of how we actually develop leaders of character at the academy. So when they come out, they're not only proficient what they've been trained in, but they're leaders of character that can lead the service.
Right. That's great stuff. And we are up against the end of the show. It's been a great show. I really appreciate it. I want to thank you for coming on today, for your service. And I also wanted to give you an opportunity. A lot of this information about GPS and the Position Navigation Timing Advisory Board, there's a website. Can you, Thad, give us the website?
Sure can. The public can go to gps.gov. They can find a lot of information and background that we've discussed here today, plus all of the proceedings of the P&T Advisory Board and all the presentations that are made available to the public. You can link through that website.
Right. Thanks. That's a great resource. Actually, I used that website when I prepared for the show. I did all my homework. Hopefully, I sounded somewhat intelligent on the show. So, but I want to thank you again for being on the show today. I want to thank you for your service, and especially also thank you for your current service on the Space-Based Position Navigation and Timing Advisory Board. It's vitally important work. It touches everything we do each day in and day out. So thank you again, and you've been listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Off the Shelf, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.